This is the Web Weekly, episode 11, for October 1st, 2010. CouchDB. In this week's episode, Kevin, Jonas, and Benjamin Young talk about Couch and the interwebs.
This is the Web Weekly, the podcast for all things web. My name is Jonas Flint, and with me today, as usual, is my co-host, Kevin Dees. Kevin, how are you?
Doing all right, Jonas.
And also, we have with us a special guest, Benjamin Young. He likes to be called Benjamin, not Ben.
Thanks, Kevin.
Benjamin, or Ben, I can call you Ben,
yeah,
right?
Sure, whatever.
Okay. Ben is working with CouchDB, and we're going to get into that a little bit. Talk about that further, but he's also done some other very interesting things here in Greenville, the Rest Fest and
yep. Little conference that I got to go to and be a part of. That was great.
Yeah, we're glad
and
to
we're
have
doing
you.
A little conference here locally called the
Open Up State.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, and that's starting to have a better turnout.
Yeah, we should be doing again next week.
Yeah, awesome. So. Good things. We're glad to have you on the show today,
cool.
Man.
Thank you very much.
So, yep. Ubuntu, you getting used to it?
Yeah, I'm getting used to Ubuntu, but I'll tell you what I like more is these headsets we have now. I'll actually be able to hear you on the podcast, so that's great.
Yeah. We've been talking about improving the audio for
cool
10 episodes, and you know I went on Amazon and found the best but cheapest headset because I'm still pretty cheap.
Well, aren't these
still
recommended by – we read an article on this. These are recommended that the Think Vitamin
– yeah, article said that these were
– that said that these were pretty good. I like how they are because the microphone's away from your mouth, so if you blow air, it's not going to go straight into the microphone. You still get a good, clean, crisp sound
right
for the recording, so that's nice.
Yeah, Kevin was having me test out P-words. Test out a P-word, Kevin. Go ahead for us.
Let's see. Pig.
You're not calling me a pig, are you?
I can't think of any more P words.
That's probably good.
All right.
Cool. So we have a lot of quick links for you today. You want to get right into this or
you don't wanna babble on at all, you just wanna dive straight in?
I don't know. We have a lot to cover, so
yeah. Okay. Well, let's do it. Let's jump right in. So what is our first quick link for the day?
Okay, I found an interesting site called webfonts.info.
Okay.
Now that the web is starting to find more solutions as far as embeddable fonts are concerned,
very cool.
There are more resources available, but you know you still have to hunt and peck around and go to Google to find them. Webfonts.info is a website that will... That kind of consolidates all of these links and all of these resources on the web.
Yeah, I see here you have – it has a nice little list. Let's see. Font Deck is on here. Web Type is on here. Google's fonts are on here. So it looks like it's a pretty good list. Definitely worth checking out.
And we're going to stop actually – giving
no
you
URLs.
The URL yeah. on the podcast. We find that to be a little bit long-winded.
Cumbersome, yeah.
Yeah, it was a little long-winded. So now we're just going to leave that on the show notes.
Right.
Cool.
So instead of telling you that it's found at webfonts.info/...
yeah, he's not going to do that.
...wiki/index.php, we're just going to say whatever.
And, of course, the URL has changed to the website, which is webweekly.tv.
Oh, yeah. Our URL has changed.
Yeah.
So, check that out. And then next.
One quick note on the webfonts.info.
Yeah.
There were a couple key sites that I saw were missing, or at least I didn't see them on the homepage. Font Squirrel, which is a fabulous commercial-free Typekit alternative,
yeah.
Which this site is using Typekit. And another one is Kernist. I didn't see them
Kernist.
As well. They're another free alternative to Typekit. And the third one is the League of Movable Type, which is a group that's developing open source fonts.
Yeah.
And they're doing some really high quality stuff.
The yeah. League of Movable and, Type. Is that any those, relation to the blog? Or?
No, no relation to the blog. It's more pointing back hundreds of years or whatever to Movable Type.
Okay. Yeah, we forgot to mention that Ben's a huge open source buff.
So I am running Ubuntu, source. Kevin. So we, yeah,
Ben's into now. It. All right. Well, that's a nice little quick link. I wasn't expecting that. It was a good little find.
And hey, then, you got to read the notes, man. What's yeah. the matter with you?
All right. So also, never mind the bullets.com. That's a pretty cool resource I stumbled upon. It's a HTML5 kind of comic thing, and it's nifty. It's panorama. Just if you move your mouse around the screen on this particular website, things move around, and it's a very good demonstration of what HTML5 can do. And you know, panorama effects are kind of become a little more popular since I think ClearLeft had their Silverback app that kind of showed off a little bit of panorama with the vines in the background. If you ever checked that out. So definitely worth a look.
Yeah, this brings back Mode 7 scrolling memories from the Super NES days.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Let's see. Then I picked up on a quick little resource from the webdesignerdepot.com, and they're basically showing off a lot of social media icons. It's the ultimate collection of social media icons.
Nice.
I actually have a project that I'm working on that I plan to use some of these for. How about yourself? Are you working on anything that's doing anything?
Currently, nothing really that has needs with that's in need of a social media icon, except for a typical share button. You know, for post this on Facebook or what have you. But I'm using a service for that. What is Share This, or have you ever heard of those services?
Add this,
or add to any.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a great resource. I'm sure I'll find use for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. Every once in a while, we'll stumble across these and we'll show them on the podcast. And I like them. I think we found Icon Set one time that we shared on the show, but this was nice to have a very specific, the social media, because you have so many sites that'll have different designs, and so all these little sets kind of can work with multiple types of design, where instead of just one set. And then also, we have, the Stack Exchange has just made an announcement. Do you use Stack Overflow, Ben?
Yeah, a good bit.
Yeah, I love their stuff. Joel and Jeff do a really good job with the site. As far as that, and they just announced, I think I found that on Joel's website, he announced that they're just launched their first beta to like full through the cycles of their Stack Exchange thing, and it's now called Nothing to Install, and this was previously the Web Apps Stack Exchange, and so they just released this. You can ask questions on this site about Google, about Yahoo stuff, anything that has to do with online applications, you can ask it here. That's the place to ask it. So it's a really good resource.
Well, what is it, a forum or?
It's a question and answer site. It's not a forum. And so they build these sites, Stack Overflow, and now this site, and I think they have Server Vault for server admins and all kinds of stuff. It's really great. And basically, it's not a conversation. They're not going after conversation in this. They're saying, here's my question. How do you solve this problem? How did you or how can you? And so you vote up which answer is the best, and you get points to that. And so what happens is people don't add in, you don't add in like, thank you for this comment or whatever. So it gets rid of all the garbage, and you get straight to the point, and it's really good. Have you had a good experience with it?
Oh, yeah. Mainly because the original questioner can pick the answer that he chose, and that's helpful to know, okay, this thing solved that guy's problem. But it's also interesting to see all the other approaches to the problem solving, because just because the questioner liked that answer doesn't mean there aren't other answers of value. And so you as a visitor can vote up somebody else's value. So there's a votes count, and then there's also like a selected answer. And I think those two different dynamics help to cut through a lot of cruft.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of how they actually do their sites. If you've ever used it, because of the point system, it creates a different type of culture. You don't friend people on this. It's not about creating fans.
It's not social. It's all about the answers.
Right. But at the same time, you can get a sense for other people's karma and follow their answers. You can become an expert. Like if you wanted to be a self-made expert in Web 2.0 apps, you would hop on Nothing to Install and just start answering every question that you had an answer for. And pretty soon you can, if your answers are good, get sort of pushed up the meritocracy ranks and be considered an expert in these sites.
Right.
So there are a lot of people that have done that, especially on the geekier ones.
Right. The Stack Overflow has been the most popular and really the most helpful to me.
Same here.
I haven't gotten a lot of points on Stack Overflow. I've actually used the Webmaster Pros more, and I have pretty good points on that.
I've used it. The only time I've ever used Stack Overflow were more for the forums. They do have user forums. Am I correct?
They have something like that, I think.
Yeah. Kind of. I think it's called the Wiki. There's something in there related to that.
Yeah, I've typed in a question in Google, and I've gotten my answers.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that's how most people use Stack Overflow. It's sort of like the open source software paradigm where they say 90% of the people are release lurkers. They're not really contributing to the project, but they are benefiting from it, which is fine.
Right.
And it's the same sort of thing with Stack Overflow. I've answered very few questions relative to the number that I've gotten answered, but it needs to be that way.
Kevin says he was how many points?
Web Pros, I have 1,000 points.
I said,
but it's still in beta.
I was like, what is this, Dungeons and Dragons?
Yeah, really right. Beta. He's got my StarCraft 2 ranking beat already. That's really good.
You play StarCraft 2?
I do. StarCraft 2, man. And 1. But
we have a real human being in the podcast. That's awesome. Dude. I'm a World of Warcraft player. So.
Very cool.
I was actually struggling when you tried to get me on WoW.
Yeah, WoW comes with a monthly subscription, so I avoid it.
Because StarCraft, this is the Blizzard.
Yeah, same company.
Same company.
It's like Age of Empires, right?
Similar. It predates Age of Empires.
Because I loved Age of Empires.
It's what Age of Empires wanted to be.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Put it that way.
Yeah. I loved Age of Empires. I would drive
you should check out StarCraft.
Check out StarCraft.
Far. And there's no monthly subscriptions. So
that's right.
It's just the one-off $60 and you're
in. What did you do to me, man? You got me playing WoW and
I'll have you know,
StarCraft.
That $14 a month is worth every penny.
See, if you're going to spend $14 a month, you need to wait like 3 more weeks and sign on to Lego Universe. That's their new MMORPG.
Hey, I'm actually checked it out. Are you going to actually play that?
I'm going to try the trial. I don't know that I'll.
Yeah, my son will.
What is this Lego? What's Lego Universe?
Have you ever played Lego Batman or Lego Star Wars? Those are awesome, right?
Right.
It's like that all the time with like very little plot line. So you're just in there and you've got pieces and you build stuff and fight people.
Can
and
you like
research
make, build your own worlds with the Legos and like blow up?
Yeah,
stuff?
You can build. You can actually script them as well. So you can.
Dude,
like one
amazing.
Example they have is somebody builds this Lego cannon and then scripts it to shoot people that. You know, come within a range, I guess. I don't know.
When I was a kid,
read about it.
I would buy every Lego there was, man. If I made money, that money was put into Legos.
It was gone.
That is all I spent my money on.
Sure.
Now, if you have a son, you'll start playing them. You have a son, right?
I do. So we get a Lego Club magazine, and it's as much for his mom and I as it is for him because we both love Legos.
We love Legos.
Those who doesn't? Yeah, you know, some offices have, like, ping pong or Wii or whatever. Like, I think you should have, like, a giant Lego table.
Absolutely.
So much more beneficial for idea creation and things like that.
That is true. Like, at South by Southwest when I went this year, they had a huge corner just devoted to Legos. It just mounds and mounds of Legos. And
Are you serious?
Yeah.
South by Southwest? That's awesome.
Super,
that sounds great.
Like, I took a picture and there's, like, 6 or 7 people just all in there building the Legos. I was tempted to go in, but
dude,
I was like,
you should have. Jump in there.
They also had like a
one leg
hanging
out right?
A pile. Legos fly up and then, you know.
Like those fast food restaurants with all the balls.
It was pretty cool. South by Southwest was pretty sweet. They also had like a little section for video games and stuff, and there was like a huge place, just awesome ships and just massive buildings and Legos. It was awesome.
Yeah. South by sounds like a really cool place. Nah, Greenville needs something like that.
Yeah, we should do it.
Yeah, we'll do that after the podcast.
Yeah. All right. And then I think our last quick link for the day is Google's doom to the world and the continuation of URL shorteners.
Oh, dear.
You know,
Hey,
I have strong opinions about URL shorteners.
Awesome.
Okay.
Yeah, but what do you guys think?
I never use them.
I want to hear your strong opinion first.
Yeah, me too.
I think URL shorteners are the doom of the world. Like,
that's promising.
When you think about a short URL, I think it's the perfect way to get viruses and all kinds of garbage on people's computers. And also,
certainly a good start.
Yeah, it's like, oh, click on this awesome link. You can't see my URL, ha ha ha. You know, it's, and also for backlinks and that kind of thing. Let's say I get a ton of links from Twitter, right?
Right.
And everybody's short URLs. As soon as that short URL system goes down, I think that happened at one point. I think Bitly or somebody bought whoever, then you lose all your backlinks.
There used
and
to be
so
one that I loved.
Dependencies. You're giving somebody your Google juice.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's terrible.
There's
really
one that
is.
I used to love called Earl Tea, because it sounds like Earl Grey Tea is what it's based off. The code's still out there, and you can get it. I think it's either Python or PHP code.
You just liked it for its name value.
Yeah, I liked it for
its
name.
Not for its functionality.
No,
right?
I mean, it was just like all the other ones. I mean, they all do the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Google's
interesting. But it's gone. It went belly up. So all my Earl Tea links died along with everyone else's. And, you know, somebody's still got the domain name, or at least they did last year whenever I had to quit using it. So, there's definitely that problem. It's a central point of failure, which we'll probably talk about the problems with that later.
With Google, though, you're
with Google?
With Google,
is Google the ultimate good of the world, and so they can redeem?
No,
awesome. I don't even have to talk.
Do I think that Google is not evil? Not sure. I have my doubts, but
they're a company. They need money to survive.
Yeah.
They're evil, dude.
That doesn't make somebody evil.
No, it doesn't make somebody evil, but it can. It's the root of all kinds of evil, right? So
right.
It's higher likelihood. Something will go terribly wrong with Google than it will with, say, you know, a smaller company that has less of you to
CouchDB.
CouchDB isn't a company, and we'll get to that later. But
right. Well, it's open source.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
No, there are advantages.
It's a central point of failure is the key problem I have, and the other related to keys is how much data of ours they own and manage, and that, of course, the concern. In that front is more related to Facebook these days than Google, but Google should actually be a larger concern, I think, for projects like Diaspora and people who are trying to get off that and do something decentralized. That, you know, you have to have an answer to the search problem, which is really Google's key asset.
Right.
Docs and things like that are all just to get us to feed, you know,
right. into the search.
The Google thing more so that they can use it to give us stuff we don't want. So, you know, if you think about it that way, it changes whether or not you'll use it. You know, a lot of what's needed, though, is alternatives to Google, not just in search, but in everything, that are equally as easy to use or have some key benefit, like decentralization, that can beat out the monster. I'm glad for all the good things Google is doing, and I wouldn't want to stop that. They just need to probably hedge their bets more if they're going to keep saying,
right.
Don't. You know, we're not trying to be evil.
A good point here to be made is Google, like with Chrome, obviously they want to make the internet faster. And so they made that browser to encourage innovation. And I think that's the key point here. And I don't know that the URL shortener is going to encourage innovation. But, you know, it's another outlet to plug into. And as many options, I believe, the more options, the better, you know?
Sure. Doesn't hurt. It's not the shortest URL shortener, but...
Right.
Do you use URL shorteners generally?
I use them on Twitter, and that's about it.
The character limit is what... I think that was an innovation that happened because of Twitter.
I think so. They were around before Twitter was popular. They were around, I think, primarily initially because of long links and emails.
Yeah.
And the fact that some clients wrap them, and if it wraps, then you lose your link. Because people didn't always know, and email clients didn't do a good job of, and they can't really, because you can have spaces in URLs. But anyway, yeah, we were only talking about the URL shortener, and that kind of went off the deep end with.
Sorry, I was just going to actually check if we're actually recording.
Yeah, I know.
The new equipment will scare you.
Yeah,
you're never sure.
Good, we didn't go on record about all that terrible stuff about Google, so we're fine.
All right. So if you want to check out this evil URL shortener that Google has made.
I doubt it's evil. I'm not sure we need
it's a
another
URL
one,
shortener.
But I doubt it's evil.
I'll not use it.
Goo.gl.
Google.
Check that out.
Yeah, check it out. They just branded all the links you want to send out to people. Awesome. Yeah.
It is kind of nice. I will say one positive thing before we close up with the URL shortener. I added mine in, and I'm guessing this works with your Google account. I stay logged in all the time, so I couldn't tell you. I should have tested it beforehand, but it tells you how many clicks, like you drop your URL in, it gives you a short URL, you paste that URL, it tells you how long it's been around, how many clicks you've gotten from that link, and like sort of like a timeline status bar. So it's kind of nice to have.
It's very cool.
Analytics.
And very scary.
So that, yeah, they put their little analytics spin to the URL shortener.
So not to speed it up too fast, but there's a Couch app, which is an application that runs in CouchDB called IO that Jan of the CouchDB project created. You can use it at Jan, which is JAN.io. You just toss a URL onto the end of it and it will it'll shorten it for you. But the code is on GitHub and you can download it, host it on your own Couch app. And it could be made, I don't know if it does this now, I've not run it, to track all those sort of analytics. But they would be just for you and not for Google.
Right.
Which is, you know, has advantages we might get to later.
Absolutely.
Cool. I think, is that all the quick links for today, I believe?
Yeah, I think that's it.
All right.
In items of news.
Right. This would be the section where we talk about specific topics.
Just a quick one.
A quick one.
The Facebook movie is coming out today. Mm. Ben, are you going to run out and go see it?
No, I'm not going to run out. I probably will.
In the same boat.
I will see it at some point, but yeah, I don't know what I'll shell out the cash to see it opening.
I will see it.
Yeah, right. Netflix is the way to go.
I will see it. Having been involved in a startup, I'm very, very interested in the story. You know, I have a free ticket. Anyway, you know, so I told him it's an excuse.
Things just
yeah, right. If I had a free ticket,
yeah,
I'd
my wife is on Facebook constantly. Yeah. You know, how you can't avoid it anymore. So she's interested.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, and
that works out well.
It's an excuse to take my wife out.
So.
That is going to be the success of the movie is because everyone uses Facebook, and that's like the biggest marketing tool ever.
Sure.
You know, people are emotionally invested in this product because all their memories that have been put into this thing. You know,
scary
also
stuff.
Their privacy. But
yeah.
That's another subject. But,
well,
you know, people
yeah.
have put a lot into this, and so a movie comes out about something that you're intimate
yeah.
with.
Sure.
You know.
Have you ever deleted your account on Facebook?
No. I heard you can't do it.
A friend of mine did it. This was probably a year and a half ago. And she lost everything that she had put into that. You know, and obviously they tell you that that's going to happen, but it, you know, it's gone, and there's no real way to get it back out. They have the API, but you'd have to be pretty geeky to get it all out. So it isn't your data.
Well, there's a service. There's a service you can use called Backupify. Hmm. You can go to that.
Which use all these Upify things.
Yeah, Backupify.com. It will back up, and I think I don't know if there's a subscription service attached to it or if there's
cool.
a paid version or if it's a freemium model. But basically, it allows you to go to all your social networks, your Twitter, your Facebook, and back up all of your data.
That's very cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
Another little quick link thrown in there.
Zip archives.
Yeah. So, but that was just something I wanted to mention because Kevin and I had a little...
That wasn't a news topic. That was...
You're going to focus on one topic.
Yeah.
That's awesome, though. That was it. That should have been a quick link.
Speaking of Facebook, though, Facebook and Skype are collaborating in bringing Skype into Facebook.
So all your chat logs are going to show up in your friends' news feeds. Right. Right?
Or even your Facebook friends are going to show up in on your Skype.
That's the precise reason I don't use the Facebook chat platform, because I don't want to chat with 600 people. I only want to chat with maybe two or three at a time.
Yeah. So what is this? What's happening with this? I have not read it. So tell me what's going on.
Exactly that. Right now, it's a speculation, but it's a plan and not a realization. You know, they haven't done the integration yet. My wife, she's from the Philippines, and she lives on Skype with her family. I talk to my mom on Skype. My mom lives in Maine, and I use Skype constantly. And my wife uses Facebook constantly, and I think it's a natural.
Sure.
I think it's a natural merging. I think it. I like it. You know, I use both services.
I want this to happen.
Yeah, right.
Press button kind of thing.
Sure.
Then I'll be okay with it. But if they just go ahead and say, you have Facebook,
ta-da,
it's on here, I think that's going to make me upset, dude.
I think that he's already upset.
He's can't all tell riled up.
I think the bigger concern I have, or related concern really, is the status notifications from both Skype and Facebook. Because I don't use Facebook chat, even though I can, and Pigeon. Because I don't want everyone to think I'm always on Facebook and feel that I'm that accessible.
Right.
Because while I may be online and I may be able to get into Facebook, I don't even like bringing up Facebook because there's this risk of 600 people wanting to chat with me. It doesn't always happen, but it does happen with enough frequency that I wish I could shut it off. And there probably is a way to shut it off. I'm on Facebook rarely enough not to do the research.
Also, chat logging. I'm not... Because they will do that.
Sure, and there's no reason they can tell you they're not, and do it for technical whatever.
Hey.
I can go on with the conspiracy theory.
We're not going to log your chats, but we're going to syndicate. We're not going to send. We're going to
keep
filter
them for
we're
analytic
filter
purposes
it for bugs and stuff, just in case.
Yeah,
a
right.
Virus.
And Patriot Act stuff, right? If you want to make it really scary.
Yeah,
I understand the privacy concerns. I don't relate because I'm an open book.
Sure.
I don't care. I don't care what Facebook sees in my chats. I really don't care. You know, I don't care who sees my chats because I don't really talk about things to be, you know,
that
so
helps.
Concerning.
Sure.
But I do see how that's an issue for certain folks. And, you know, there are options as far as keeping yourself invisible. And, but again, you have to be on the platform enough to, you know, do the investigation to.
Right.
Hide that stuff. But what else do we have, Kevin?
Well, you shot me this link. I think it's like really soon after it came out or something. WebP, Google's new, and I'm guessing this is in conjunction with their WebM.
The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, right.
I'm guessing WebM,
the Death Star. No.
WebM is a web movie, I'm guessing, and WebP is web picture. Is what they stand for. So this is Google's basically file type for...
It's their answer to the JPEG.
Right. It's their answer to JPEG. I actually used it. I'm running Ubuntu, as you said. See, you can't bash me for using Ubuntu. I can do things.
I don't bash
you.
I have Ubuntu on a laptop. Yeah, right? I just think sometimes it's...
It's a labor of love, man. Don't knock it.
Sometimes it's more of a headache to get to what you need to get to. Like install
that's
something.
That's because you don't know how to use it.
Sure, or like get your brightness on your monitor to go up. I can get it to go down with a command line utility, but I can't get it to go up.
Yeah,
that is one thing we did say is the hardware stuff for Ubuntu.
Yeah.
You have to really pay attention to the hardware that you buy if you want to use Ubuntu.
Yeah.
And there are a few of the big guys that are doing some integration with it, and some smaller groups that have laptops that you can buy that are straight up Ubuntu integrated.
You know, the first time I ever laid eyes on Ubuntu, I swung by his office and he had it on his the big
was
blue hat office.
It probably was this laptop.
It might have been. And I said, "What are you doing? What are you running?" And it was Ubuntu.
Yeah.
And I've installed it and since have used it, and
it's
I do
a lot
like it.
Now too.
But you know, the driver support was a headache, and you know, there were little things that were just like, "Ah, I just got to get my work done." You know.
Yeah. Right. So. Yeah, it's a labor of love.
Yeah. So WebM.
Once you get it running, back it up.
That's what you call it.
Back on topic.
Yeah, that's what I call it.
WebM or WebP.
Yeah, it's a bad name.
It's basically a higher compressed version of JPEG, which is the one that.
Is it a whole new standard? Or is
it's open source. You're going to like that. It's source.
That's the one good thing that Google's still doing.
Right, it's a whole new file format. I used it. I compressed a specific. I just picked any kind of JPEG out, and I compressed it from 60K to 40K, which is, close to 20, 25%.
Yeah.
It was somewhere
that's
in
notable.
There. That's huge. That's and the quality was still there. And I only – the way you do it in the command line is you specify the quality level that you want. And I only did like 80, and it was still the same as 100% JPEG. So if I had bumped it down to 50, it may have been smaller and still good enough quality to use. So, sure. You know, you could probably get a whole lot more out of it. I think the smashing or no. What was the link you shot me? Mashable.
Right? Yeah, it was a Mashable.
It was Mashable. I think they said like 46% compression or something like that. So yeah.
Which
that's significant.
Judging from what's on the WebP page on Google, it will be great once there's broad browser support. It's not even in Google Chrome yet.
Right.
So there's promise to it.
There's also no image viewer for it yet. So if you make a web...
Yeah, yeah, I have a smaller file that I can't view.
You can't view it, and so you have to convert it to a PNG and then look at it to see the actual quality.
Oh, dear.
So you cut back on the size and you convert that to JPEG or PNG.
So about a year and a half ago, Yahoo had a thing called Smush It, which a couple of guys in Yahoo had kind of done this side project, and then Yahoo rolled it into YUI. And I think you can still get to it with their Firebug add-on, the YUI page speed thing. And as a service, that was excellent. I mean, it took JPEGs that had been compressed in Photoshop and made them smaller, and they were still standard JPEGs or PNGs. It actually preferred PNGs.
Photoshop's compression is not very good. They have a web export feature, but even that compression is not as good as it needs to be. And there are several articles online and all over the place I've seen that show you how to compress it better using Photoshop, and also better compression with Fireworks is much more substantial as far as PNGs go.
Yeah.
If I'm not wrong, wasn't the PNG supposed to be the answer to...
Right, portable network graphic.
Right, to the JPEG?
It sort of combined the advantages of JPEGs and GIFs and then added on to that with opacity and things like that.
One thing I'd like
to know... And now that's all I use. I use...
Yeah.
Yeah, with WebP is if it supports transparency. If it does, that's pretty huge.
Sure. If it doesn't...
Right. Well, even if it doesn't, you still get a smaller file size. But the versatility of having transparency in a very small file size is huge.
Well, how does it compare to the pink? The PNG, PNG.
Sure.
As far as the quality goes, I think PNG is a lot better quality, but the file size is like 20% more than the JPEG when you get in large sizes.
Or to WebP. How does the WebP compare to...
I did not. I only converted from JPEG to WebP, so I couldn't tell you there. But, you know, from what I've seen, it's good. I think there may be a future for this. It's going to come down to this. Server-side browser detecting. There's going to have to be something in PHP and all these other languages where it says, okay, you're using this browser. I'm serving up this file type. That is the best way I can see that ever working, where it is you get this style sheet because you're using this browser, and this style sheet has the WebPs versus the JPEGs. That way you can start using it now. Because if people don't start using it, if there's not a quick uptake,
it'll die.
There's a thing in HTML5, and Google might shoehorn this in now that they have WebP. And for the video tag, you can now provide it several different formats, and your browser, beneficent as it is, will pick one that it thinks is best and show you that one. So you could provide WebM and Ogg Vorbis and whatever else, and then depending on which browser it is, it'll A, pick the one it supports, and B, pick the one that it thinks is best. And that's debatable how it decides that. So maybe with these image tags, it could do the same in that if they add this to HTML5, which they might, Hixi works for Google, they could provide that same sort of thing where you have an image tag with several source options with MIME types, and then the browser says, oh, I support these, and I'll give you
parsing.
That. Which is kind of scary. But, I mean, HTML for a long time has had a low source thing. I don't know if it's going to make it into HTML5 because so few people used it. But you could do a smaller, typically in the early days, meaning like late 90s, you would do like a low source with a black and white GIF that would come up first.
Right.
And then your full color JPEG would come along after that. And the browser did all that for you. So it would load the smaller ones immediately with the idea that you get your page layout and get an idea of what the page is going to look like, and then all the pretty colors would come into the world the longer you waited. Right. This was the 14 and 26K modem or 28K modem
right.
days.
Oh, modems. Right.
I remember
Yeah,
being
so
able
that's
to
probably
specify,
been dropped. I don't know.
Specifying your source code, how your image would load.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could have it tile sure. down or like
yeah.
The little checker box, you know, so yeah. you could get different levels of load this way, load that way. So that was kind of cool.
Right.
So predictions, Kevin, where will WebP be in 2 years? What do you think?
WebP will be in Chrome.
It
better
be. If
it
takes
Chrome.
2 years, yeah.
You know,
well,
I think Chrome moves fast.
WebP will be in Chrome pretty,
right. Well,
pretty soon.
Yeah.
I think it's dependent on how well WebM does. If WebM makes it in, I predict that WebP will follow. But I don't think that browsers are going to take up on WebP unless they take up on WebM. That's my prediction.
What's your prediction, Ben? Just for fun.
Sure. I think it comes down to, which he didn't give a prediction either, so I'm going to do the same. It comes down to how Google does with their patents on both WebM and this WebP thing, and how they manage getting that into other browsers. We all know they can get it into Chrome, and yeah, that's great. And if it's in WebKit in the core, it'll by default make it into Safari unless Apple has some serious reason not to do it, or now BlackBerry or Palm or anybody else using WebKit. But they've already gotten WebM buy-in from Mozilla, I believe, at least tentative. It's not in Firefox yet.
Not yet. We'll see.
Yeah. And a lot of that, I think, is a patent question. If it were open, and, you know, whether that was through the Open Innovation Network or somewhere else where it's like, this is maybe patented, but we promise never to sue you for your use of it, which is what IBM's done with a lot, that would be different. But I'm not sure if that's the case or not.
My guess is it'll exist. But it won't be around, or it'll exist but be unused. I think
really.
If it doesn't support transparency, I see it as being a pretty steep edge case. It's,
yeah, I don't
it's
see
also
it.
Got,
that is true.
It's also got creation standards to, or Leap. It'll be used in Google Docs and in Chrome and stuff like that probably, but if Photoshop doesn't output it,
yeah.
90% of the web development community won't touch it.
Adobe will take forever to get to it. I don't see it. I think what we have is good enough. I don't know about that
because this is the reason I say this, okay? Mobile browsing. Mobile access to stuff.
That's true.
Okay?
Which
this is becoming
here translates
huge,
to
this
Android.
Is, this is becoming a huge topic, really, when you think about it. Desktop, when you have high-speed access on your desktop and you can plug straight in, that's great. But over, what is it? What's the percentage? Like, you're talking about people in Africa and
right.
all across the world use mobile devices primarily. And so if you can cut back 50% of their bandwidth.
Yeah, but there are already mobile image standards that people use for mobile devices that are even smaller and intentionally lower quality for viewing on feature phones.
Right.
So I don't know.
So, well, our.
It'll make it onto Android.
Are mobile speeds getting faster or slower, though?
We hope faster.
They're getting faster, right?
They're getting faster. But part of that has to do with file compression as well.
Yeah. I think old habits die hard. I'm used to using the good old ping, and the good old ping is what I'll probably be using.
And the good old ping hasn't been the good old ping for very long, so there are still people who don't use it and hardly even know it's there.
Yeah, it really hasn't, and it's been a joy to use.
Yeah.
So far. So.
Opacity is all you need.
So.
CouchDB.
CouchDB.
Yes. It replicates.
It's on my shirt.
Replicate. Have you seen the little rap video?
Which one? There are two now. So. You should check them both
that's
out.
That's two rap videos.
So
where can you find those videos at? They're on YouTube.
That is a good question. I think we linked to them from the Couch One blog at some point. They are on YouTube.
Yeah.
I can get you the links and we can add them to the.
Okay.
The quick
so,
for, the day
for those who don't know, what is CouchDB?
CouchDB is a document storage database that uses JSON, the JavaScript object notation, for both the document storage and its representation on the wire and use in consumption, which JSON is already used a lot in Web 2.0 sites because it's native to JavaScript as a as an object notation, which is what the I don't know how geeky you want to make this. The object-oriented format in JavaScript is what JSON was birthed out of, and now it's also used as a data serialization format, mainly because it's lighter than XML and more stable than something white-space delimited like YAML. So it has advantages in that it can be compressed and all the white space can be taken out of it as far as, you know, pretty white space. So it makes it small and portable. And anyway, so that's what CouchDB uses for its document representation. It then has an HTTP API that uses RESTful style principles to do CRUD or create, retrieve, update, and delete actions on documents. So it's very familiar if you've done any kind of AJAX work or any work with a browser, really. I mean, you can get all your documents out of it. And if you use Futon, which comes with CouchDB, it's sort of like the PHP myadmin of CouchDB, you can turn on Firebug and watch Futon use jQuery.couch.js to actually use CouchDB because it's using the same API that you'll use in your app. So there's no, like, download the database and then download some library to let you use the database. The database and its API come in one package, and that API works on anything that can open a port. So as long as you've got an HTTP port, even internally, you know, it can just listen locally to a port, then you can interact with it with anything that supports HTTP, and every decent programming language does, and anything that supports JSON, which is the same group.
Right. So like with, say, for instance, MySQL, I have to use their library to access MySQL using MySQL or MySQLi.
Right.
So yeah. With
or MySQL ND.
With CouchDB, I don't have to have an extra library in my code because it's using RESTful, which is basically HTTP.
Right. It's just HTTP
access.
Used logically, because HTTP has verbs for getting, posting, which is like appending to a collection. Putting, which would be creating or updating something, and then delete, which is deleting. So it just uses those the way Tim Berners-Lee intended, right? And it just operates on those, and the database listens on an HTTP port, and you issue delete such and such a document, and it deletes it, and you put such and such a document, and it creates it. So it's very simple, very easy to get your head around, and it's not some magic library that you have to install and then learn a whole API of, you know, which one, and then decide which one of these do I want to use, you know, because this one's faster, this one supports version 5 up, and this one supports version 4 down, which MySQL I is only for version 4.1 and up.
Right.
Because they changed some things in the protocol. HTTP hasn't really changed a whole lot in 10 to 15 years. And it's probably not going to change so significantly in another 10 to 15 years that it would mess CouchDB up in any way.
Right. So. And just to give people an idea of really what CouchDB is, this is not a relational database. This is what they call NoSQL.
Right. Which stands for not only SQL. The phrase NoSQL ticks a lot of relational database people off, and understandably so.
At first blush, it's hard to get my head around it.
Not only SQL. The concept behind that is not new. There has been document storage databases and graph databases and things like this for years. Somebody coined the phrase, sort of like AJAX. You could do AJAX long before the word AJAX came into being.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jesse James Garrett, for giving it a name so we could all do it.
2006 that AJAX was?
Yeah, 5 or 6.
Yeah,
it's not a...
That's when it was given a name.
That's when it was coined. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
AJAX, baby.
And Jesse James Garrett doesn't actually write AJAX apps. He's just a UI guy and does information architecture stuff and does fabulous stuff if you ever want to read his things. He works... at least did, for Adaptive Path. I think he still does.
Yeah.
And they do amazing things. So he just happened to coin the term. So somebody along the way coined the term NoSQL, and it's stuck for a whole bunch of new databases that don't do SQL, and that's about the end of their commonality. Beyond that, there are key value stores, there's document stores, graph stores, whatever. CouchDB is in the document database camp.
That's awesome.
It's hard for me to get my head around it because I've always related databases with SQL.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you're accessing tables, and to access tables, you have to say this column with these words and with right. This number or whatever, you know. And with Couch, my assumption from what you're saying, because it's HTTP, mm-hmm. you'll be able to, instead of saying select star from, you would just simply say HTTP in your URL /1, meaning one cell,
right.
from, so you'd be like /1/name/.
Not quite.
Just yeah, describe how that works.
It doesn't have atomic granularity.
What is that?
That means you're only ever going to get a whole document without using MapReduce, which we can get to in a second. So the HTTP API that CouchDB uses has a URL for a database.
I see Jonas over here. He's like, ah, geeky.
It feels like a tech book.
All this white noise is entered right. in. Poor Janice. No, it's really quite simple. It's easier to show than it is to explain. But because it's restful in a way, every database has a URL. So you've got a URL for your Couch instance. And then /database name. And inside of that database are all your documents of all kinds of types and structures and whatever else. If you think of...
And that's stored anywhere. Like...
Mobile phone, anything.
Yeah, yeah.
When I think database, I think data is stored within a table.
So some quick history and just very high-level history. Relational databases were created out of a need... that was driven by hardware constraints because we could only store so much information in so much memory space because of the limitation of tape and things that we used at the time.
Right.
So we had to break data down into these pieces. And because we had such limited storage, we didn't want to repeat any of it. So right. I want to keep it in one place and I want to get it from that one place from now on. I don't want this value. Jonas's social security number to show up anywhere else in my database.
Well, it seems efficient. I mean, it was right. built sure. for efficiency.
Redundancy
Except
versus...
It's efficient on the storage layer. It's not efficient in putting it in or in taking it out because you have to deconstruct the natural format of your data, which is typically a document in the real world.
Right.
You have to deconstruct that into something that is... inhumane.
Or text.
It's you know, it's in columns and rows, which is not how people think or how people consume data. So you broke it up into all these pieces to store it because that's how you had to get it on the disk. We don't have that limitation now, and we store things all the time as full documents like this podcast list of links that we're looking at, which if we were to turn even this list of links into a relational database to store them in the categories they're in, and things like that would take several tables and a lot of hours to build forms to let us enter it as if it were a document, bust it up into all these tables. And then when we want it back, we got to put it all back together again. So with computing, you're always moving costs around and deciding where am I going to spend my time?
So almost like tables take apart information.
Yeah. Right.
Sort you of have like to the Legos fragment that we information. Were talking about before. I had this nice spaceship I built.
Right.
And now to store it, I have to take it apart and put it in all these little compartments.
Yeah, right.
Yellow, green,
right.
blue.
Right. Exactly.
Instead
right.
of just taking this awesome ship right. and sitting it on the shelf to pull it out whenever I need it.
And very often, we'll say like in the MySQL 4.0 pre-days and probably other databases, MySQL is the one I'm familiar with. I mean, no disrespect to them. They do awesome stuff. You didn't have views, right? So you've taken apart your Lego thing and you've categorized them by yellow, green, blue and the different sizes and you've got a bag for studs and whatever else. And then you've got to record where you're going to put this all back together.
Right.
Where does that live? It didn't live in the database. In early days, it lived in an application. So you wrote applications to do nothing more than manage how the data got in and out of the database.
Right. And how it's put together, which is...
With CouchDB, you don't have to do that because it's right. schemaless. So any data, any document, any JSON document you give it, it will store it as long as it's valid JSON. So you don't have to think as a developer, how am I going to store this? I mean, you do because you're going to read it later. But outside of your personal concerns, you don't have to worry about what the database may or may not want you to do with the data. You just put it in, and it goes in, and it stays in, and you don't lose it, which is nice. Whereas with breaking it up into a relational database, sometimes you would change how your application worked in order to match how it had to be in the database.
Yeah.
Which is really, you know, it's tying your hands unnecessarily. So yeah. The web has progressed to the point, and hard drives and everything has progressed to the point where that's not a concern, and we can live on schemaless databases. And the invention of MapReduce lets us go through each document one at a time and pull out common parts or the pieces we want,
right.
So and reassemble a different view.
Right.
It would be like your joins or your queries, and those are all stored in CouchDB.
Now, has CouchDB really, have they been able to accomplish that kind of feat? Can you really store the data in such a way?
Yeah.
Really?
You as long as you give it a JSON document, and the JSON document can even have binary attachments. So you could put this podcast with all its ID3 tags and whatever other annotations you want into a CouchDB database, and then replicate that to a phone or to whatever else might be running CouchDB.
So you can insert images, MP3s.
Right.
Anything you
right.
want. Another JSON
yeah.
file inside of...
Exactly. Yeah, you could attach another JSON file. It could be plain text. It could be whatever. You just have to declare that it's an attachment, and you do that by either putting it at a specific URL or inside the document under a certain key, and then Base64 encoded so it knows it's an attachment.
Now, so far, my first question was going to be, how do I get one of those awesome shirts?
One of these awesome shirts? Well, I you guys on the podcast can probably see this.
It's a CouchDB shirt.
It's a CouchDB shirt that says the very important word relax,
right.
Which has kind of what we were talking about schemaless data storage and just putting it in.
I can understand.
That's what it's about.
I've always wondered why CouchDB and, why it was named that. It seemed kind of odd to me. But now I'm starting to understand.
Yeah, Couch actually stands for something. It stands for Collection of Unreliable Commodity Hardware, and that points to a lot of how it was architected.
What's the DB stand for?
Database, I think.
Database.
It is a database.
Dumbbell.
It's a document. Yeah, dumbbell. It's a document
dumb
database.
Boy.
Yeah, right.
Dumb,
it needs to be something couch-related, right?
Yeah.
Like some piece of a couch. No,
sorry.
It stands for database because it's still a database. It's just a different breed than what most people refer to when they say database.
Right. But my real question was going to
sure,
be,
how do you get one of those? We have a cafe press store.
Oh, okay, great. how has the adoption rate been as far as normal and regular web designers?
Sure.
Such as myself. Like right now I'm using Drupal.
Right.
And occasionally I'm peeking in.
Yeah.
I'm looking at WordPress right now.
Right.
Do you have plans to talk to, I think it's Dries Bajutar and
sure.
these people that are the headmasters
yeah.
of mm-hmm. these CMSs
sure.
to get them to adopt something such as
right.
CouchDB. How has that been?
The biggest uptake hasn't been in those categories yet. It's been at a larger enterprise level. It runs the gamut. So I don't want to say that CouchDB is an enterprise-level database and that's the only people who use it because that's not true, but we have a lot of case studies on couch1.com about the BBC's use of it, and they're storing billions of documents. Anytime you create a user profile at bbc.co.uk, your personalized data, the things that you personalize about the page, is going into a CouchDB instance that's managing all of that. The Hedron Collider that's doing atom smashing and who knows what all is storing some of its data in CouchDB. And we have other case studies that show how it can be used on a large scale. There's also a case study for a guy who created a super simple application called Thingler, which is just a to-do list app where you bring up Thingler. I think it's Thingler.com.
Another to-do list.
Yeah, right? We've got a lot of those. And this one's super primitive, but it shows how quick he built it in a few hours. And it's just a big text field and it says, what are you doing? And or what do you want to do? And you just type it in and hit enter and it gives you another one and you just, and then you can check them off.
Y-A-T-D.
Yeah, right. So, exactly. It's yet another one. So, the general web development community, of which I've worked my way through, is one that I care about and one that I really want to see pick up CouchDB because I think it has a lot of advantages over the typical way of doing things. And I think CMSs especially could benefit from it, Drupal especially, because of how it is sort of misusing the MySQL database by like using it as a key value store to begin with,
could really
benefit from breaking rank and doing it on CouchDB. They won't because not yet.
They're having trouble getting over to object oriented just because of the way
Because of that. They won't yet probably because of, and we're trying to fix that, because MySQL is so pervasive.
Right.
So it's there. So
the
we're using
adoption.
It and we have to.
Yeah, for
it.
Sure.
Right.
So one of my objectives is to see CouchDB available in the places where everyday web developers are. So they don't have to say, well, I can't really use that because I don't know how to install it or my host won't let me install it, which is more likely the case. If it was just there, then they would likely just use it because it was there and they could see it as an alternative. The company that I used to work for, the one that I ran, Big Blue Hat, had a CMS that and still does. It's still available.
Blue Ink.
Blue Ink.
Yeah.
Yep. And that is a PHP MySQL app. And one of the first things that sold me on CouchDB was how much easier it would have been to write it on CouchDB had that been as stable as it was 3.5 years ago when I started Blue Ink. How much easier it would be and how much easier it has been to rewrite it onto CouchDB because it's schemaless and has MapReduce and all these things. So that rewrite is going to be open source under an Apache license. The very primitive beginning is available on GitHub at github.com/bigbluehat/blueink. You can go take a look at it. It's kind of hardcore couch app right now. You'd have to get into the MapReduce to really understand what it was doing and how it was doing it.
For those who don't know, what is MapReduce?
MapReduce is something that's fairly common in programming languages. It's two methods of going through an array, typically. A map function takes each value of an array or a collection of something and runs a function on each one of those. So in the CouchDB world or the Hadoop world or any of these databases that support it, it goes through each document one at a time and runs some function on it. So typically in CouchDB, you're checking, does this document have these keys in it or is it of this certain type? And if it is, then I'm going to output either the document or just these pieces of the document that I want. Like imagine you have a stack of business cards and invoices and I don't know, something else. And you go through these documents one at a time looking for addresses. And you say, okay, here's a business card. I know it has address fields. Or you check for the address field. This one has an address field, city, state. I'm going to output just the address, city, and state. And then I found an invoice, and it has address, city, and state. I'm going to output that too. And so you've got all these addresses keyed by just a number. You say like one, and then you know your address, another number one and somebody else's address and then another number one and the same address that you output first. And by doing this, you have every address that appears. Some of them are going to appear multiple times. You can then use the reduce to count all the ones for every time. Actually, I've got those backwards. You put the address in the key and the number in the value, and then you'd iterate through those values and say, give me a total for any time this address shows up, show me how many times. And you could run queries then to say, you know, I've got X number of documents that contain Jonas's address or whatever. Yeah. And you can do far more complex queries, but that's kind of the concept that you go through. If you think of it's how you work with documents, you open up that junk drawer in which you put all your receipts and you say, I need to find out how much money I spent at Coffee Underground. So you go through each document one at a time because that's how people work. And you put all your Coffee Underground receipts in one stack and everything else goes into another stack. And then you total up what's in your Coffee Underground stack and you have your answer. Yeah. It's like that, but a whole lot faster and easier to do.
Yeah. I have one question. I know we're getting close to time here, but if you could briefly, and I've asked you about this before, security implications with CouchDB. Sure. Because you're using JSON, right? Mm-hmm. There, to me, and you're using HTTP.
Right.
So you could easily, say, run an eval on, which is basically a JavaScript function that lets you run a string as JavaScript.
Right.
You could somehow have cross-site scripting problems, whereas, say, you're running a form and somebody drops some JavaScript in there. They can query your database, whereas previously you couldn't query a database because it was on the server-side code.
Sure.
And you're using a file.
One of the things that prevents that is that we don't have ad hoc queries. So all the queries are stored in the database. And to do that, you have to be an admin to get access to that section anyway. So you have to have a decent login. And if you did that, you'd have to store it as a valid function. And it couldn't just be, it's not in a normal document. So nobody's going to edit your database and dump in some JavaScript that's going to query your database. It's just not possible. Those two things don't mix. Because there's not this PHP or whatever language app layer that could accidentally let that happen. Because your app layer isn't running ad hoc queries. It isn't saying select star from whatever. It can only say get me the result of this query that you stored earlier. Some layers do allow you to edit those MapReduce queries through the PHP layer. That's debatable whether or not you should really do that. You can, certainly. But once it's in CouchDB, it's cached and pre-processed and things. So because there's not ad hoc, it's unlikely that you're going
right.
to run into that.
And I would think that would be a concern for designers who are just getting into the idea of a non-relational database and also, I guess, a non-normalized database.
Right. This is very denormalized.
Right. And so to me, I feel like it would be a question that would arise for a lot of people. And it did for me is, if this is using JSON, and I can use HTTP to get this, what does that mean to my visitors? They can grab it, and because of the ad hoc thing.
Right. It's mostly going to depend, too. The querying part is not possible. Somebody could inject some JavaScript into one of the JSON documents.
Right.
And then
SQL, too.
Sure. And your app, if it's not written well, could eval the doc that it got back and run that JavaScript. But that, again, is only going to happen on the client. And that's the web developer's fault, not CouchDB's.
Right, exactly. And you would have that problem with MySQL or any of these other databases.
Or Twitter, which just had an XSS problem that we all got hit by.
Yeah.
So it's not uncommon, but it's a client-side issue, not a database issue.
Now, Couch, the company name is
Couch One.
It's Couch One now.
Yeah, it was Couch.io, and then we changed it to Couch One because no one could think of how to say Couch.io or Couch.io or it's just a lot simpler. And we've got one API, one CouchDB API that exists on several platforms now, Android, laptops. We're working on iOS products.
Now, are they a for-profit business or are they?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a fully funded for-profit business that's building services around CouchDB and contributing heavily to the open source CouchDB project. So far, everything that I've written at Couch One is Apache licensed and available on either the Couch One or the Big Blue Hat repo, depending on where I happen to start it. But it's all there. It's all Apache licensed. And we're going to be funneling tons of stuff back into CouchDB.
Yeah. Awesome. If I think you can get into the web design and development community, the less enterprise community, more so if there's a way to not dumb it down, but dumb down the explanation.
Sure.
Right.
Make it more sellable.
Yeah.
And pretty the package up a little bit.
That's why we love bloggers.
And
this is
exactly
how to do
yeah,
it.
This is
you know,
and
your
I've,
foot in the door.
Sure. And that's one thing I've started since I've come through the PHP community. All the guys at Couch One are working on it for their different domains or the places where they have experience. So there's a lot of activity in the Node.js crowd and things like that. I'm one of the few PHP guys on staff or that have PHP as a heritage, even though Jan has an at php.net address because he's contributed to the core of it. I've spent time on PHP code for CouchDB and built a project that I call Slouchin, and it's on my GitHub thing. And it uses cookie-based authentication, which CouchDB supports, to allow you to authenticate a user through your PHP app, but then just keep the cookie and manage editing the database locally without having them log directly into CouchDB using the cookie key. And anyway, you can see that code. It uses the SAG CouchDB wrapper, which is just some PHP code that uses HTTP streams. Anyway, it uses his stuff to interact with CouchDB and show off how to wrap a login system, which is something people do with MySQL all the time. So I'm hoping to kick out more code like that that says, if you're wanting to use CouchDB instead of MySQL or whatever, here's how you would do it. Here's some sample code.
Yeah.
You can just pick this up and fix it.
Maybe a video or...
yeah. We've got a lot of
a little
couch
demo
app.
Video. And...
We've got a lot of couch app videos, which are applications that live in CouchDB. But a lot of people are having trouble really jumping that chasm because it's a different way of thinking. And a lot of us have languages that we've spent a lot of time with, like PHP.
Yep.
And CouchDB uses just JavaScript. So
old habits die hard.
Yeah, right.
You're going to fight with that a little bit, I think. Yeah,
sure.
Sort of like the WebP thing. But where can they find CouchDB?
They can go to couch1.com. CouchDB.org, I believe, redirects to the official page, which is couchdb.apache.org.
So this is an Apache project.
It's an Apache Foundation project. Apache is a nonprofit that manages all the intellectual property in that. And we'll do that in perpetuity.
And
so
Couch runs on Apache as well.
It runs behind Apache. You can proxy that. Yep. Yeah, it's not a problem.
All right. Well, Ben.
Yeah.
Thanks for being on the show.
Happy to be.
Can folks find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Big Blue Hat. That's probably the easiest way to find me. You're also welcome to email me at benjamin@couch1.com about any CouchDB questions, especially the PHP ones, because I still have a soft space in my heart for PHP. I still do a lot of PHP. I just joined a PHP project called Web2 Project. That's a project management system, and it's all MySQL and PHP, so I'm still doing that kind of stuff as well. So, yeah, please hit me up with CouchDB questions.
All right, and I guess Ben's a little too modest to pimp his own CMS, but Blue Ink
is your CMS. Sure. BlueInkCMS.com if you want to check that out. There's a demo that you can try, and check out the fork as well. We'd love to have help on that. The end game for that, hopefully, is to be an Apache project. Also.
PHP MySQL, currently in its stable state.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Ink is in PHP MySQL.
Yeah, it's written in that, but it's sold as a software as a service, so that code is all managed and upgraded regularly, and you pay a subscription fee to get to it. And we'll follow the same model with the open source version, and the subscription will mostly go towards support and added value, like a template library or something like that.
Yep. Well, great.
Awesome.
You can find me online at kevindees.com. And Jonas, where can folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter, at Jive, J-I-V-E, or email me at jonas@01productions.net.
We need a good
URL shortener for Jonas. Jonas needs a 0.io.
Until we get... Shorter email addresses, but that's zeroneproductions.net. And I think that wraps it up.
All right.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Well, yeah, no problem.
Thanks for coming, Ben.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Have a good one, guys.